This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here at the People Speak, when the people speak, we make a difference. And wow, this is, I'm really thrilled to have Don Lenton tonight, the author of the Harvard Psychedelic Club. Although Don has written a number of other books, one of them, one of my all-time favorites, Follow Your Bliss. It's a pleasure having you with us tonight, Don. This book that you have written is just fascinating. It goes like this. The 1950s, a decade defined by conformity, consumerism, and conservatism, were coming to a close, and a new era of social, spiritual, sexual, and psychological revolution were beginning. It seems to me that we're still in that, we've returned to that era of conformity, consumerism, and conservatism down these days. But before we go into that, it is a pleasure having you on our show.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Fascinating. Just now, this book deals with four of my favorite people in the world. Although there are dozens and dozens of other characters and real life characters that kind of weave throughout the entire book, and some of the connections I had never made before and didn't know. So, but Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil. They killed the 50s and ushered in the new age for America. That's a pretty tough statement. When you say they killed the 50s, you know, there's so many ways that people can take this. If you look at the way we view drugs now in retrospect, or view drugs during that time, was it a good thing or was it a bad thing, Don?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying by killing the 50s is, I mean, these guys came together in the fall of 1960, so the 60s were just beginning. They all were working or studying in and around Cambridge, Massachusetts, either at Harvard or at MIT, and it was just a fascinating kind of turning point in American history. You know, I mean, a lot of the 50s, I was a kid growing up in the 50s, and it really was a time of you know, conformity and consumerism, and it was the whole post-war economic boom was happening, and the whole, you know, McCarthy era and the political paranoia and the fear of nuclear annihilation. I mean, it was a heavy decade, and you know, the 60s, while, you know, they had their own horrors in various ways, I mean, especially in the early 60s when JFK was elected, which was in November 1960, which is when this story really begins, there was a real spirit of hope and optimism in the country. A little bit like some of us felt when Barack Obama was running and was first elected. You know, some of the people I was interviewing for the book said it reminded them of that era. And of course, Kennedy was, you know, the senator of Massachusetts. He was a Harvard man himself. So there was just something in the air, I think, in that season and in this particular place. And as you mentioned, all kinds of, you know, fascinating characters pass through this story. And it's not, you know, it's sure, there are a lot of stories about drugs in the book, but it's not just about drugs. It's about really the changing of a whole kind of a social, that's a new social era, really, embarking on a whole new social era.
Wow, it almost feels forward. Like it's limiting just to call it a social era, because in fact it was every kind of era. It was a spiritual, a new revolution in spirituality, a revolution in society and social conformity. Just everything happened during that period of time, and I don't diminish this at all. I think it's a, I was kind of like, Ken, you know, I think it was Ken Kesey, that had said that he was too young to be a beatnik, and too old to be a beatnik and too young to be a hippie. So that's kind of where I fell in. So I kind of viewed all of these people from the outside looking in, admiring the lifestyle, admiring the flower power, admiring the just the color to young people was so refreshing, all of this excitement, this exhilaration. And yet at the same time, you know, as a parent many years later, you know, I look at Timothy Leary and I wonder, my God, was he all that brilliant? Was he certainly was an interesting character.
Yeah, well, maybe we should talk a little about who these guys were, because I'm not sure your readers your listeners really know, do they? And sort of set the stage of the story before we talk about the implications of it. I'm not sure people have the
background. Talk to me about Timothy Leary, probably the one of the greatest, what they call the drug gurus of the century.
Okay, well, yeah, Timothy Leary was... In the fall of 1960, he was 1 year into a three-year appointment at Harvard. He was a clinical psychologist. Of course, he hadn't become infamous yet. And what people forget, because Timothy Leary did become, you know, he was such a revered and reviled character later on in the 60s that, you know, people kind of forget, you know, where he came up out of. And in the late 1950s, he was seen as a rising star in clinical psychology. I mean, he wrote a book. Especially was personality assessment, and he wrote a book that was the book of the year, the American Psychological Association, and he was a brilliant man. He had a lot of character flaws, which we can discuss later, but he really was a brilliant guy. And the way the story really begins with Leary is he's on his summer vacation in the fall of 1960, and he has an experience on a summer vacation down in Mexico with magic mushrooms. Psilocybin mushrooms. He was down there with some colleagues and his two kids. He was a single father at the time, raising these two kids. Anyway, he had this, and I read about this in the book, he had his first psychedelic experience down there. And he later called it the most profound religious experience of his life. He was completely blown away by this. And blown away by it in several senses. I mean, he really thought that. I mean, he came back to Harvard in the fall of 1960, convinced that psychedelic drugs. He hadn't done LSD yet. These were psilocybin mushrooms that came later. Mm-hmm. But convinced that psychedelic drugs could not only revolutionize psychology by helping us understand the way the human mind works, both the psychosis and enlightenment. But could really change the world, could really be the beginning of a whole social movement. So he came back to Harvard really on fire, and he started this project called the Harvard Psilocybin Project, which in the book I call the Harvard Psychedelic Club. Later they called it the Harvard Psychedelic Project. And with a colleague of his, a professor by the name of Richard Alpert, who later would go on to off to India later in the 60s and return as Ram Dass, a real well-known spiritual teacher of my generation, the baby boom generation, they started this project. Well, at first they were just trying to figure out how these drugs work, and both of them were surprised that they were having spiritual and mystical experiences, because they were not, you know, spiritual or religious men. They were secular scientists. So they were surprised that this was all happening. And so the third character in the book is Houston Smith. Now, Houston Smith was already a well-known religion scholar, expert on the world's religions, and he was teaching down the road at nearby MIT. And he was brought into the project sort of as a theological consultant, because Houston was an expert on mysticism and spirituality, and they wanted his assessment as to whether these were, quote, authentic spiritual experiences. So Houston was brought in to do that. And plus, Houston had been writing about mysticism, but he had never his book, the now called The World's Religions, originally called The Religions of Man. There's like 2 or 3 million copies in print. It's still in print. It's like the textbook for kind of religious studies 101, still in a lot of colleges and universities. And this book had just come out. So he was already, you know, an authority on world religion, but he'd been writing about mysticism, and he'd been meditating. He was a student of the Vedanta school of meditation at the time, but he'd never had what he would consider a full-blown mystical experience. So he wanted to try these drugs as well to see what that was like. So those were the three of the four characters, and the final character in the book is Andrew Weil, who many of your listeners will know of from his fame as in holistic health, so natural foods, alternative medicine. He called it integrative medicine, bringing together the best of Eastern and Western medicine. But back when this story begins, in the fall of 1960, Andrew Weil is a freshman, undergraduate at Harvard, younger than the other three. And he tries to become involved in the project and is rejected, and the story sort of goes on from there and talks about what happened with the four of these characters. And then goes on to sort of look at their whole lives and for the next few decades and assess the impact that they had on the culture in various ways. And mostly, as you mentioned, in terms of the main two ways, I think, would be the whole question of mind, body, and spirit, how we look at the mind, body, and spirit. And I think together they really helped to revolutionize the way Americans see religion and spirituality, and also the way we look at health care. So and those are the two main areas I think they had a big impact.
Well, obviously, the broad spectrum of ways they impacted or the ushering in of the New Age. And I don't know, we talk about the New Age. Some people say it's really an old age.
I actually hate those words.
You don't know what to call them.
Robert Bly, you know, remember Robert Bly from the...
Yes.
The man's movement. He called it newage, as in sewage, rather than new age.
Well, that's a good one. I probably like that because you know, when we talk about it, people say, "Oh, you're a new ager." It's like, you know, I feel offended by that. It's like, really? I mean, it's
people who I would call new agers never like to have that label put on them because it's sort of it got a kind of a derogatory kind of silly. Reputation. I don't know, sometime around, you know, Shirley MacLaine and all that back in the 80s. But I mean, what I'm really, this is when people say they're, I mean, forget about New Age. I mean, today, you know, I wrote about religion for the San Francisco Chronicle for 20 years as a newspaper reporter. And every year, more and more people I would interview from all, you know, walks of life and from different faiths would say things like that. They would say, I'm into spirituality, not religion. I mean, I hear that so much, and I'm sure you do too.
You almost don't know what to say. Call it. You almost want to call it something individual to yourself, but if you do, nobody knows what you're talking about.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think what people mean, and some people are not really sure what they mean, because you know, spirituality. I'm sorry, is a part of religion, right? But
exactly.
I think what people mean by that is they're interested in personal spiritual experience. The experience of religion, rather than doctrine and dogma. And we do have a kind of a radical individualism in this culture. We always have, and it's applied to religion. You know, everyone is off, you know, growing their own religion, or you know, mixing and matching and combining. And there's so much of that going on now. I mean, in all kinds of ways, not just the so-called quote New Agers.
Don, do you know these individuals personally?
I've interviewed Ram Dass over the years, you know, as a journalist, and Houston Smith as well. I know Houston. I mean, I don't know them as friends. I knew them as people I reported on over the years. I met Leary once before he died. He's the only one who's still not with us. Leary died in 1997. And I had never met Andrew Weil, but I did interview, you know, the three survivors for the book. They all cooperated. It's certainly not an
authorized group. And they were okay with that. Let me ask you, were the experiments conducted on this done in any kind of scientifically documented fashion, like we have 10-year studies that are done today, and there is a formula and for doing these kinds of studies? Did they follow any process or procedure when it came to these studies?
Yeah, they did. Actually, as serious academic studies, they really allow all kinds of problems with these two studies. You have to remember that LSD was legal until 1966. And people didn't have the same idea about it, if they'd even heard of it. They didn't have the same idea as they have now about LSD. We associated with the hippies and the Grateful Dead and, you know, all of that, Summer of Love. At the time, even before these guys started in 1960, there was a lot of research going on, serious academic research going on into various ways we might be able to find beneficial uses of psychedelic drugs. For one thing, people were studying treating alcoholics with psychedelic drugs, not in the sense that they would be helped to understand their own lives and look at their addiction and their lives in a different way. So there were various things were going on. Also, the CIA and the Army were doing some very nefarious research with LSD to see if it could be used as a chemical weapon or a truth serum or sprayed on enemy troops as kind of a weapon of mass distraction rather than destruction. So there was all kinds of research going on before Leary and Alpert started this project, and they did two main projects. One was called the Concord Prison Project, and this was the only one that Leary was intimately involved in, it was a double blind. This was a fairly serious project, but there were some problems with it. It was a double blind experiment giving psilocybin. This is like synthesized psilocybin, so it's like a controlled dose of the same drug you would get in psilocybin mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And they were giving psilocybin to prisoners at Concord Prison to see if it would help reduce recidivism rates. So that was the purpose of this project. So it was a double. This actually wasn't a double blind study, and that was the problem with it. So they were giving these prisoners. Well, what was revolutionary about this project was not that they were giving prisoners drugs. All kinds of people were coming in and using prisoners as guinea pigs in drug tests then, and still are in some places. What was interesting about this is they were Leary and the graduate students who were working with him were taking the drugs with the prisoners and talking about their problems together in sort of sessions of kind of mutual exploration, self-exploration. So there was a real intimacy and a support that went along with these drugs. And then when the prisoners got out, they would continue to meet with them and counsel them and help them and maybe also have one or two additional sessions with psilocybin, therapy sessions with psilocybin. And Leary claimed a very dramatic reduction in recidivism rates among these prisoners. But the problem was there wasn't a control group. There wasn't a group of prisoners who got the psilocybin but didn't have all the other support, right? So it was impossible to know how much of it was because of the drug and how much of it was because of all the other attention that these guys got. So that in itself really, you have to sort of discount any findings that they have. And even on top of that, someone went back years later and looked at Leary's data and realized that he'd fudged a lot of numbers anyway. So that was Leary's main project. And he really didn't come about this as a serious scientific experiment. He really left science before science left him.
Well, I think that, now, and this is my concern, because, you know, as you watched Leary in many interviews throughout his life, you saw a diminished capacity. Do you believe that based on the amount of, I think he originally was taking like something like 600 doses during periods of time, during the course of his research, do you think that that affected the research to the point where it diminished it, and that's why he started to fudge numbers and do the things that he did?
Well, you have to actually not even call it research. I mean, what happened with Leary he really did one serious research project, and that had problems. What happened very quickly is this thing went from being a research project into being either a drug cult, a big party, or the beginning of a social movement, depending on how you want to look at it. But Leary did have hundreds of, and Alpert too did hundreds of LSD sessions of LSD and other drugs. It's amazing actually how intact their minds were, considering how much they had done. Leary's main problem, I don't think, was that had too many LSD trips. He actually could, for the most part, handle that. He was a real megalomaniac. That was his problem. I mean, he was even before psychedelics. I mean, people use the term megalomania to describe Leary. So it's interesting because a lot of times when people take psychedelic drugs, I mean, there's like an ego dissolution. I mean, they lose the sense of themselves. They even can kind of become one with everything, which can be a experience or can be a frightening experience. In Leary's case, it seemed to intensify his megalomania. It strengthens his ego, which was already working overtime. So it's interesting with him. And with Alpert, you know, I think Leary is really kind of the four characters. I argue at the end of the book that Leary is actually the least influential of the four in terms of influential in a positive sense.
And he was the one that consistently and continuously used the LSD.
He slowed down a bit, you know, later on in life.
Houston and Weill also ended up stopping their drugs after a period of time.
Yeah, for the most part, they did. Yeah. But it wasn't so much that, but they really took the experience in a positive direction. I mean, when I said before that one of the things that Houston was interested in finding out was whether these were, quote, authentic spiritual experiences, I mean, what Houston concluded, and there was another project we can talk to if you want, which is called the Good Friday Project, where they involved divinity students. But anyway, Houston concluded, and I agree with him, that yes, you can have, in terms of the brain chemistry, the same kind of experience, spiritual experience that someone else might have through other means, like meditation or chanting or some other spiritual discipline. But that's not the important question. The important question is, does that experience make you a better person? Does it make you more aware and compassionate person? And that's really how you judge.
I think people are still asking those questions, aren't they?
Hmm?
Aren't people still asking those questions about religion or spirituality or metaphysics in general?
Sure they are. I mean, you should ask that question about any spiritual practice, and you should also ask it about psychedelic religious experiences. And I think a lot of people actually did come out as more aware and compassionate individuals. Most people who took psychedelic drugs, you know, in the 60s and 70s and later, you know, did it a few times. Maybe did it once. I mean, a lot of people I talked to for this book and talked to in other books, you know, they would say they did it once, but years, decades later, they still say it was one of the most profound experiences that they had, and it changed the way they see the world, and see themselves, and see their connection to everything else in the world.
And I know, Don, you spoke of your own personal experiences in the book about with psychedelic drugs. But before we go into that, we do have a caller on the line, Samantha. Samantha, you have a question for Don? I guess we lost Samantha. Well, I do have a question from Mike in California, and he says, "Hi, Don. I was wondering if you thought the LSD drug experimentation of that time turned self-centered and hedonistic for many people rather than mind-expanding." And I think this is what we're talking about. What are your thoughts on that, Don?
Yeah, I think it could. I mean, I think a lot of the people who had trouble with drugs and from my generation, they got something from the psychedelic experience initially, but they didn't find a way to incorporate it into the rest of their lives, and it became, you know, it was hedonistic. There was a lot of hedonism in with Leary and Alpert in this movement too. It's one of the reasons that Houston Smith separated himself from it. Like I said, it became in some ways like kind of a wild party, which a lot of the 60s was. So sure, there was that excess. Of course, I think there was probably even more of that with other drugs, like not psychedelic drugs. I mean, I think psychedelic drugs for many people gave them a glimpse of something, and then they moved on. But you know, definitely, you know, there's obviously a lot of drug abuse in the 60s, and you know, someone asked Alan Watts, you know, the Buddhist scholar Alan Watts, if people should, you know, keep taking LSD after they've experienced it, and his response was, after you get the message, hang up the phone. You know, the drug is a tool.
I love the way he thinks. He was one of my favorites, actually.
Yeah, no, he's great. And he's also in the book. I mean, in the Harvard Psychedelic Club, he passes through early on, and you know, and that's kind of what Richard Alpert who went on to become Ram Dass, you know, said. I mean, he realized that drugs were really not the way. I mean, yeah, they could give you a taste of a spiritual experience that it's really better to go after in a sort of a kinder, gentler, softer way. And, you know,
I think that was the big thing with all of the drugs, a lot of, and meditation in general. People thought that the early people that experimented in these drugs, such as the people that we're discussing right now, were in a hurry. They were in a hurry to get enlightened real quick.
Everything was now. It was
now.
Yeah.
And we were a very desire-based system of living. There was a desire-based system of living during that period of time, and it was like suddenly we had permission to do these things, so we did.
Yep. Right. You want it all now.
Samantha is back with us on the line. Samantha, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Do you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Samantha. You have a question for
Don? Yes. Hi, Don. Hi.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be on with you guys. I am, well, the 60s were before my time, way before my time, but do you feel the era was naive to in its idealism? And what happened to the idea of peace and love that was so highly touted then?
Yeah, you know, there really was an idealism, and in a positive and in a negative sense. I mean, I caught the tail end of it. I mean, I was born in 1953, so I was like 16 in 1969. I think the 60s really the 60s continued into the 70s. So I just caught the tail end of it. But I remember, I mean, we thought we were really going to change the world. I mean, there was no doubt about it. That was the feeling that a lot of us had. And sure, that was naive, but there was also an idealism, and a lot of people, you know, changed the way they lived, simplified their lives, you know, sort of didn't buy into the whole materialist consumerist mentality, and there were a lot of people who went in different directions, and all kinds of things happened, you know, the Peace Corps, and of course the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, you know, all kinds of things were happening in the 60s, you know, progressive social movements, and you know, the whole what happened to the, you know, the peace movement or peace and love. I mean, I think I've often asked myself that question. Why isn't there more of an anti-war movement now? And, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, one is that there's just not a draft. I mean, the Vietnam War, you know, people were getting drafted who didn't want to go. There wasn't a volunteer army. So that was a big part of it. But there just seems to be such apathy, you know, today about what's going on in the world. I'm sort of at a loss.
Can I ask you, do you sense that same type of the consumerism, the conservatism that it seems to be flourishing in all of our political systems today, the throwbacks to evangelical, you know, the tight, rigid, dogmatic religions that used to, you know, rule everything. Do you sense that same feeling now?
I think there was a real backlash against the 60s, which really picked up in the late 70s and 80s, especially with the election of Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
There was a backlash against all that, and a kind of a more repressive era, and then a more materialistic consumerist era, and I think these things go in cycles. You know, maybe things starting to shift back now. Maybe not so much voluntarily because of what's happening with the economy.
I Phil in Australia has a question for you, Don. He's asked, could Don comment at the McUltra connection to the 60s, MK Ultra. I'm sorry, MK Ultra. CIA mind control via drugs.
Right. I mentioned briefly that some of the research that was going on in the 1950s was conducted by the CIA. Also, the Russian intelligence and British intelligence were also doing a lot of research. You know, this drug was you know, discovered in the originally in the 30s and got rediscovered in the 40s. And in the 1950s, people were trying to figure out what to do with it. And one of the things that because the North Koreans and the Russians were trying to see if they could figure out a way to use this as a chemical weapon, these drugs as a chemical weapon, the CIA and the Army got involved and did all kinds of bizarre and dangerous research with LSD. And a lot of this was under a program that was called MK Ultra. Now, I don't really get into this in my book. I mention it because there have been several great books written about that already. Storming Heaven, and Acid Dreams are two of them, two of the titles. And in the end, I do interview someone who was involved with some research that was funded by the CIA at Harvard early, very early on in the early 50s. This person didn't even know it was, you know, funded by the CIA. Often it was a front group that would be funded by the CIA, and the researchers wouldn't even know who was paying for the research they were doing in the 50s. But, you know, there was a lot of very nefarious and dangerous, much more dangerous than anything that Larry Nauford did, at least at Harvard. But like I said, I didn't really get into it too much in my book because Leary and Alpert really weren't part of that.
Exactly. I think they were more into I want to call it the fun parts of
Not just fun. They saw it as an issue of Leary saw it as an issue of cognitive freedom. That we should have the right to alter our consciousness in any way we see fit, as long as we're not harming someone else. And that was for him, it was part of it was as a civil rights issue, but they were also it was a spiritual movement. I mean, they really thought, and you know, they realized and said later that they were very naive about this, but they really thought that they could change the world for the better with psychedelic drugs. They really believed that. They sincerely believed that.
Talk to me about Andrew Weil. I guess
My book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, it's really, I mean, the story of Leary and Alpert at Harvard has been, you know, written up before. There have been a couple biographies of Leary, but I think what's new in my book is really the role that Andrew Weil played in all this. And like I mentioned before, Andrew Weil was much younger. He was an undergraduate at Harvard. And when Leary came back from Mexico in the fall of 1960, he started this Harvard Psilocybin project, which involved initially mostly just giving the drug to graduate students who would basically write up reports about their experiences. And they agreed with the university, Leary and Alpert agreed not to give the drug to undergraduates, because these drugs can be dangerous, psychologically dangerous, no doubt about it. And so they only thought older students should be part of this. Well, Andrew Weil was an undergraduate, but he was very interested in this. He had read Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, which came out in the 1950s, which Huxley is also a character. He happened to be around Harvard at the time all this was going on. But anyway, he had read Doors of Perception, as had the other men in my club here. And he wanted to be a research subject, so he volunteered, and Leary and Alpert told him that, sorry, we can't use undergraduates. But then what happened is about a year later, an undergraduate friend of Weil's by the name of Ronnie Winston was brought into the fold and was allowed to take these drugs, as were some other undergraduates. And Andrew Weil got very jealous that he was not included, and basically went on a crusade to bring Leary and Alpert down, to get them fired from Harvard. And he did it by doing a series of exposés in the Harvard Crimson, which is fine, but it's kind of the way Andrew Weil went about this that there are still hard feelings 50 years later about the way he did this. It's an amazing story. I mean, Weil's friend, whose name is Ronnie Winston, son of Harry Winston of the Harry Winston Diamond Jewelry family, a very prominent East Coast family. He had been brought into the fold by Alpert, who was at the time a gay man living in the closet and had a romantic attraction to Ronnie Winston, which is one of the reasons he made an exception. And so there was a lot of jealousy on various levels going on here in this story. But Ronnie didn't want to admit publicly or to the university that he had been given psilocybin. Because he was either having a good time or thought it was an important research project, or for whatever reason, and none of the other undergraduates did either. So Weil, what happened is Andrew Weil went to Ronnie Winston's father and threatened to put his son's name in the paper as being part of this Harvard drug scandal, unless Ronnie told the university that Alpert was giving them the drugs. Weil was both working as a journalist and as a spy for the Harvard administration, which is a flagrant violation of journalistic ethics. He was doing both these things at the same time. Under pressure from his father, Ronnie Winston did go to the president of Harvard and was asked, did Professor Alpert give you psilocybin? And Ronnie paused and said, well, yes, sir, he did, and it was the most educational experience I've had at Harvard. Well, they didn't care about that. They had that's what they needed. They needed evidence to get Alpert fired. You know, he was on tenure track. You have to cause to fire a professor at Harvard. And so it was really Andrew Weil who got Alpert and then Leary kicked out of Harvard. But like I said before, they were already, they had already left science. They were already, Harvard knew they had two loose cannons on their hands. These guys were, it was really the psychedelic 60s were starting right there. This is where it all began. The scene in San Francisco hadn't really got going yet. You mentioned Ken Kesey and all that. That was a few years later. So it was really the beginning of an incredible time in American history, and it, probably it's the best thing that ever happened to Leary and Alpert, because they got kicked out of Harvard, sure, but there was a page one story in the New York Times, about it the next day, the day after the Harvard Crimson broke the story, Andrew Weil broke the story, and that immediately catapulted Leary and Alpert onto a national stage as the two leading spokesmen of this the beginning of the psychedelic drug movement. Which we associate with the 60s so much now.
It was such a colorful time. Now, earlier I had mentioned that in the book you talked about your own experiences. And you had some bad experiences with LSD. I think this is a great time for us to take a little break, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for broken.
Forever Fresh disposable undergarments offers a convenient, economic option to men and women who suffer from minor incontinence. Forever Fresh is a patented, internationally award-winning brand that allows the skin to breathe as naturally and comfortably as cotton garments. Environmentally friendly and hypoallergenic, the undergarment features a built-in incontinence pad pocket to be used when extra absorbency is needed. Forever Fresh is available at participating Walgreens. To learn more, you may also visit foreverfresh.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. We have our guest with us tonight, Don Lanton, author extraordinaire of the Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith and Andrew Weil killed the 50s and ushered in the new age for America, and they most certainly did. I don't think we've ever really quite recovered from those days, have we, Don?
No, you still see, for better or worse, the fallout from that era and from what these guys were up to, no doubt about it.
And it certainly is. I wouldn't have it any other way. I know that they inspired me in so many ways. Vietnam. No matter whether I believe in drugs or the use of recreational drugs or not, what ended up happening was a very profound experience. And for me, they did usher in the new age of spiritual experience for a lot of people, and that was very profound for me. So I don't have any regrets about seeing what happened.
Yeah.
They were an interesting crew of people, I'll tell you that much.
Mm-hmm. They certainly were.
We have another question from Samantha, and she asks, how does Don feel about California and other states trying to legalize marijuana for recreational use? And what does he feel, and what he feels about how the government is trying to close all the pot clubs that are trying to help the cancer patients and others that benefit from it?
Well, my personal opinion is that marijuana should be legal. And, you know, in California, I mean, it practically is. It's like a traffic ticket now. I mean, they actually lowered the already, you know, meager penalties in the face of the proposition we had to, you know, to legalize marijuana, which did not pass. But, you know, and it's so easy for people to get a medical marijuana card. I mean, I think there are legitimate medical uses for marijuana, but I think most people who have these cards are just recreational users anyway. I mean, I think anyone who, you know, is around this scene can see that. So, you know,
I just think they don't all have cancer.
Hmm?
I said I certainly hope they don't all have cancer out there.
Yeah, well, the other thing about, you know, about the legalization issue, I mean, we haven't talked about this, but I think one of Leary's legacies is that, you know, Richard Nixon called Leary the most dangerous man in America. It's a famous line, Richard Nixon talking about Timothy Leary. And Leary responded in classic Leary fashion. He said, "Oh, yeah, well, I have America surrounded." Yeah. And in a way, he was right. I mean, Leary was a dangerous man for the establishment, for authorities. And he was, of course, not the only reason, but he was a big reason that, you know, Nixon declared this whole war on drugs, which, you know, is one of the longest and least successful wars this country has ever waged. But forgetting about the whole thing of whether street drugs should be legal, recreational drugs, what Leary did is he inspired a backlash against serious scientific research into the possible beneficial uses of psychedelic drugs, which were already going on before they created this, you know, huge controversy and later on in the 60s. And it's interesting. This was all shut down. You know, scientific research was shut down. And that is just starting to come back now in the last 5 or 10 years. And there's all kinds of really fascinating. I get into this in the book a bit, but I also just did a magazine article recently about this because there's so much going on right now. There's a whole renaissance of, you know, above ground FDA, DEA approved research into psychedelic drugs. One of the most interesting studies they're doing is a pilot study giving MDMA, which is known as ecstasy, the drug that a lot of people used in the whole rave scene in the 90s, they're giving ecstasy to returning Iraqi and Afghan war vets who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and along with therapy, seeing if ecstasy can be used to help them sort through the psychological damage that these wars have caused for, you know, countless thousands of returning GIs. It's a huge problem. They don't know how to deal with it. And this is a study that was approved by the FDA, and it's going on right now. So that's just one example. So there's a whole new scientists and researchers are looking at all these drugs again and finding that, yeah, you know, with carefully controlled, you know, therapeutic situation, there can be beneficial use of these drugs. Also for people struggling with end-of-life issues, grieving issues, like I said before, even for alcoholism and drug abuse, these drugs can be used. Believe it or not, drugs can be used in some people's minds to help addicts and alcoholics look and examine their lives and their relationship to, you know, the substance abuse. So there's all kinds of interesting stuff going on.
Don, do you know if during the O'Leary period in Vietnam that they used they gave any of these drugs or included Vietnam vets in any of the research?
It pretty much stopped. That CIA Army research had pretty much stopped by the time that was more in the 50s and maybe very early 60s. Vietnam vets, the drugs that Vietnam vets were getting were amphetamines. I mean, they were passing out amphetamines like, you know, candy to these kids. And, of course, a lot of the
vets got addicted to, you know, heroin. That was, well, the Army wasn't giving it to them, but it was just available, you know, in Vietnam and Cambodia. It's just a long, sad story in this country with these vets. You know, they come back so psychologically damaged. And so it's kind of interesting that now people are trying to use this drug to kind of help people suffering from psychological trauma. So.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I think there's a lot more work for us to do in relationship to hallucinogenics and psychedelic-type drugs. You know, during the 60s, there was an incredible genre of music that that happened. It was like a happening. Mm-hmm. Did O'Leary, do you know if O'Leary, I know that like Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead, Joan Baez, Keith Richards, John Lennon, some of them were involved in the drug, but was there a direct correlation or relationship
between them? Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. As a matter of fact, the Beatles, Timothy O'Leary directly inspired two Beatles songs. John Lennon wrote, it's the last song on Revolver, which was before Sgt. Pepper's. It was the first kind of psychedelic infused Beatles record, the song Tomorrow Never Knows, which was the lyrics were directly taken from Leary's and Alpert's book published in 1964 called The Psychedelic Experience, which was a guidebook for using LSD to take an LSD trip. And LSD was legal still. It was legal till 66. And Leary's book was based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So it was really, some of the lyrics in a sense were based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but Lennon read about it through Leary's book. I mean, he used Leary's book as a guide for his LSD experiments early on in the mid-60s. And then, of course, the Grateful Dead took their name from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That was where they got the dead thing. And then the Doors were, that was off of the Doors of Perception, Aldous Huxley's book. And of course, the Moody Blues had a famous song about Timothy Leary. Is Timothy Leary's dead? And
he
ran for governor against Ronald Reagan for governor of California. You know, obviously kind of a joke campaign. But and John Lennon wrote a song, a campaign song for Leary, which was "Come Together," which is another Beatles song. Which later they turned into a Beatles song on, I think, one of the last Beatles albums. So yeah, music was such a part of this. But it's interesting because when the scenes in this book, they were in the early '60s. That the whole '60s rock thing hadn't started yet. I mean, they weren't wearing tie dye. They were wearing, you know, button down shirts and skinny ties like the characters on the, you know, Mad Men.
I think you're right. They really, literally did help usher all of this in. This kind of this happening that happened during that period of time.
Yeah, and then of course when the scene moves out to San Francisco, you know, the rock bands, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, all that. That was music was such a part of it. The Grateful Dead came right out of the Ken Kesey, you know, acid test. They were the house band for Ken Kesey's group. So
just fascinating. You know, one of the things too, we had Bill Ayers on our show last year. Fascinating man, wonderful, incredible.
Yeah, he pops up here too.
he certainly was a character, and he was one of instrumental in helping O'Leary leave the country.
Yeah, no, it's not O'Leary, it's Leary, by the way. But Leary. He was with the Weather Underground. Yeah, he and Bernadette Dorn were. Leary was imprisoned on a relatively minor marijuana charge, lengthy prison sentence, and he escaped from prison in Southern California prison with the help of the Weather Underground, including Bill Ayers and Obama's favorite terrorist.
I thought that was a pretty far stretch, if you ask me.
Oh, of course it was. I was kidding. Helped Leary escape from prison and smuggled him to Algeria.
Just unbelievable. In Afghanistan, I thought he was.
Yeah, he wound up. I mean, Leary was in Algeria living with the Black Panthers, who had a whole kind of embassy in exile there, and then the Panthers, he had a battle with the Panthers, and they actually put him in their own version of prison. He had escaped from the Panthers. And then he wound up in Switzerland for a couple of years. And then he got kicked out of Switzerland, and he was wound up in Afghanistan and was kidnapped by the CIA and brought back to prison. So the guy has, I mean, Leary just had an incredible life. I mean, and then he became a government informant to get out of prison and alienated a lot of his friends on the left. So
he certainly didn't have a lot of friends after that, I don't think.
Not for a while. I mean, most people forgave him because he actually did. Turns out he didn't really do a lot of damage from his snitching. A few lawyers got in trouble, but that was about it.
Bill Wilson was experimented with LSD, and the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah,
and I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, actually, I'm working on a whole book, kind of a prequel to this, it goes into the whole story of Bill Wilson, Aldous Huxley, and Gerald Hurd in detail, taking this back another generation. But yeah, Bill Wilson people forget that he was a very interesting guy. He was a very eclectic spiritual seeker, and he thought that LSD could be used to help alcoholics have the spiritual experience, revelation that they're supposed to have according to the 12-step program to overcome their addiction. It wasn't as wild as it sounds. There was a lot of research already going on about treating alcoholics with LSD before Leary ever even tried it.
Do you think drugs have gotten a bad rap over the since the Reagan era?
Well, it's always what drugs are you talking about? I mean, it's very arbitrary which drugs are legal and illegal. I mean, most of the abuse that goes on right now is with pharmaceutical drugs. You know, there's an incredible amount of abuse of Oxycontin and various pharmaceutical drugs. So, you know, it's like what's legal, what's illegal. Because alcohol is the most, probably the most dangerous drug in this country. I mean, it's also the most dangerous for Leary. Leary was an alcoholic. His main problem drug he had was alcohol, and as did his father and many of his family members. So just what drugs are you talking about? You know?
Well, I meant the psychedelic form of drugs and marijuana, the drugs.
Yeah, I just think those drugs,
what people call recreational drugs.
Yeah, I think those drugs cause much less problems than alcohol, pharmaceutical drugs, and cocaine and heroin. I mean, marijuana and psychedelic drugs psychedelic drugs can be psychologically dangerous. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But they're not addictive. And if you know what you're getting, which is kind of the problem, because you don't know what you're getting because they're illegal, and the criminalization of these drugs causes more problems than it solves, in my opinion.
Do you think if they were made legal that it would not be causing as many problems as they do?
I definitely think that. I also even think that harder drugs. I mean, the fact that heroin is illegal is not stopping people from using it and creating, like, you know, half the crime in this country. I mean, it's that the war on drugs has been an abysmal failure, in my opinion. I think practically all drugs should be legal, and there should be drug treatment centers for take all that money you spend on the criminal justice system, and the people who want to get treated, people who do have problems with these drugs, put them in treatment. Allow people to deal with their addictions. I mean, now people are, you know, there's long waiting lists to get in a lot of treatment programs.
Well,
are all upside down as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate your insight into this entire revolution that happened to America many years ago, and I think we're still feeling the ramifications of it. The Harvard Psychedelic Club, please go and get the book. It's humorous, it's interesting, it ties people that you would never have imagined into it and weaves it throughout the story. Thank you, Don, for being with us tonight. Next week's guest will be Scott Horton of theantiwar.com. Looking forward to talking with Scott again. And thank you very much, Don. It's been a pleasure.
Have a good evening. The
people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering. Hey, hey. this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.